morning's reading is from Matthew 7, 1 to 6, which is the same as we had last week. This is a continuation of Barry speaking, and today it's on criticism. Judging others. Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces.
I want to ask you a question. Actually, I'm going to ask a few of you for your response to this. Phil, you're a thinker. Who do you think was the greatest hero of World War II? Okay. What do you think, Jay? Who do you think had the greatest influence in World War II?
Vera Lynn.
Well, that's two highly intelligent answers, so I'm going to ask a woman. Rob, who do you think, Pat?
If it was Second World War.
Weary Dunlop. Yeah, well, he was a great Australian, wasn't he? He did a magnificent job. Any other comments?
Corrie ten Boom,
she was so brave and went through so much. Her sister, according to Corrie, was the absolute hero, wasn't she? But Corrie came out of it and influenced the world.
The Hacksaw Ridge,
yeah, he was a hero too, yeah. Would you say those people are the greatest?
The unknown soldier,
yes. You're a good pair. I don't know, troublemakers. Yeah. What about Winston Churchill? Yep. What about Winston Churchill? Yeah. MacArthur. Yes. Yes. I don't have very many recollections of my dad because he died when I was 11. But you know, I can remember him telling us that Douglas MacArthur saved Australia. Yeah. And you got to say Eisenhower was a great general too, wasn't he? A great strategist. But I want to suggest to you the man who probably saved more lives than any other was Alan Turing. Who knows about Alan Turing? Bruce does. Yep. Okay, not too many. Alan Turing was a kind of unbalanced individual, people might say. He was a brilliant mathematician. He was brought in as a code breaker, and the Germans had the most complex code that had ever been put together. It was brilliant. And he broke it with his team. So it meant that through much of the war, they knew exactly what the Nazis were going to do. But they could not respond every time. Why not? They would know that they'd broken the code. Could you imagine the pressure of the people who had to make that ultimate decision? They knew those planes were coming. They knew they were going to do this particular area, but they couldn't warn them because they had to think of the big picture. But Alan Turing, who was ridiculed and who was almost fired several times, his brilliance brought about that. And some people say probably he saved more lives than anybody else in the war. When the war was over, a police officer became suspicious of him. They were so scared of the Red Menace, not the Red Menace, well, it was the Red Menace, the spread of the Iron Curtain, as Winston Churchill described it. And so some of the British were accused, and accurately accused, of spying for Russia. And this police officer suspected this man, Alan Turing, had some secret. Do you know what the secret was? But he decided, well, he must be a spy. And so he turned his life inside out and found out he wasn't a spy. He was unable to say what he did in the war because of the official secrets. So he was never held up as the hero that he was. But they did find one thing about him. He was homosexual. So the police officer was really dismissing that whole thing. He went back and he said to the boss, you know, no, he's not a spy. You know, we found out the secret inside he was homosexual. The boss said, that's criminal. We will prosecute him. And he was jailed. And after it, he was so shamed and embarrassed and broken by it all, this man who had saved tens of thousands of lives, committed suicide, cyanide. Jesus said, don't judge other people. Don't look for the weaknesses in others. Don't get excited about digging up the dirt. He said, don't judge other people. And of course, as Christians, we are known for it. We are known for it because we are judgmental. Because we are judgmental. Admiral Jeremy Border, do you remember the story about him? He was the first enlisted man, just enlisted into the Navy, to rise to the top of the Navy. He was in charge of all US naval forces. He was involved in leadership right around the world. And in Europe, he headed up their defence. Admiral Border. After the Vietnam War, you can imagine the number amount of letters, as they say, the banners that he had on him. He just had everything. He had one that he shouldn't have had. It was pointed out to him and he took it off. See, he had been on a warship in Vietnam, but he hadn't set foot on ground. And you had to have been on the ground to wear that bit, so he took it off. Years later, Newsweek gets onto this. How exciting. We've got a photo of this man wrongly wearing this medal. They rang him at 12:30 and said, look, we are going to expose you on this. Years before. We're going to expose you on this. 12:30. 1:10. He killed himself. He left a note saying, I don't want to embarrass the Navy. Jesus said, don't judge other people. Why would you do such a thing? Well, you say, they're gigantic issues, you know, big people that we don't... Let me tell you a story about a woman I know well because I started working in retail when I was just 15 years of age. I wasn't one of you bright ones who went right through. I had to do all my studies later. Started working behind a counter. There was a lady there, a dear lady. She was middle-aged and a wonderful woman, wonderful to work with. And every lunch hour, her younger sister would come in and they would have lunch together. It was hard to imagine a better relationship than anybody on earth. They were just wonderful. I found out the story. See, when the younger sister turned 21, you had to wait till 21 in those days. Now it's 18, I think, isn't it? Anyway, when she turned 21, they had a big party. And at the party, one of the neighbours said, look, I think you've got the right to know. You're not sisters. She's your mother. You were born out of wedlock. What a nice... I won't say the word. Old woman she is. What do you think? Jesus said, don't judge other people. Don't look for the flaws. Don't look for the mistakes. Don't look for the hidden bits. Look after each other. That's what Christ is saying. And so you'd have got so many stories, and you could tell stories like that, but even worse than that, some of us might be able to say, we've been in the place of pointing the finger. Yeah, all the excitement. I'm not gossiping, but I want you to know, Kay, about this girl that you're sitting next to, because not everybody knows about her. You know, that's that sort of stuff. Isn't that what goes on? Well, I want you to come with me. Phil took us there, so come back in your mind. And now we're back in the days of Jesus. And I want to talk to you about the family of Jesus, his relatives. Now, if you're brought up a Catholic, you have a bit of trouble with what I'm about to point out, but I'll point out to you it's in the Catholic Bible as well. except they say cousins, but the word is brothers. Okay? Both Matthew and Mark say that Jesus had brothers and sisters. Let me read you this. Jesus left them and went to his hometown, accompanied by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogues, and many who heard him were amazed. "Where did this man get all this?" they asked. "What this wisdom that's been given to him? What are these remarkable miracles that he performs? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son, the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? And aren't his sisters also here with us?" And they took offence at him. They took offence at him. Well, the brothers and sisters of Jesus, there's a stage when you, if you go to the Gospel of Matthew, you'll see that they doesn't suggest that they're full believers. They're having trouble themselves. Can you imagine? See, Mary was probably just a teenage girl, because usually in those days, the girls were married off from 12, 13, 14 years of age, and the husband was usually quite a bit older. And so Joseph and Mary have children. They're listed by name there, the brothers, and there were girls as well. So it's quite a family. And then Joseph, you'll notice, is not mentioned again after Jesus reaches, you know, about 12. So it's thought that Joseph died and was off the scene. So Christ would have been the oldest male in the family. And some suggest that's why he didn't launch his ministry until he was about 30, because he was helping getting the family through those years. So now Jesus is out and he's doing miracles and he's preaching and everybody's trying to work out exactly who he is. And Mary knew it was a miracle because of the virgin birth. But they come to him and they're outside in the Gospel of Matthew. And they came to him and said, you know, because Jesus is doing things for everybody else. They said, "Hey, your mother and your brothers are outside." And he said, "Who is my brother? Who is my mother? Who is my brothers?" And he says, you know, the world is really, it's this shift. Now, they do go on to be believers. Mary ends her days being cared for by John the Apostle, just as Jesus asked from the cross. But his brother James becomes an outstanding leader in the church. As a matter of fact, the first church council, where the leaders of all the then churches come together for a conference on what's the church meant to do, James is the one who presides over that. But he goes further than that. He goes on to write a book himself, the book of James. Now, James is a controversial book. Not because anything he says is controversial, it's because what he says doesn't necessarily fit in with the way that some religious leaders think. For example, Martin Luther, the founder of the Protestant Reformation, he said, "James should not be in the Bible. It is an epistle of straw." Why did he say this? Because in the Reformation, because of the emphasis that had been made in the Middle Ages church on works, you've got to do the right thing, you know, it's your works that justifies you to God. The Protestant Reformation discovered the emphasis in the Bible, where we are told it's by faith. That's how grace comes, not by works. Paul writes, "Not by works, lest anyone should boast." Well, of course, James, his whole emphasis is on the "show me your faith by your works. Faith without works is dead." And so Martin Luther, because of his extreme emphasis upon grace rather than works, or faith rather than works, he says, "Oh, this book's no use." But I'm yet to meet a Christian that doesn't think it's a great book. What do you think? Yeah, it's so down to earth, isn't it? So practical. Well, he not only talks about works, but he talks about this same subject that Jesus is talking about. He says, "The tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark." She's not your sister, she's your mother. Could you imagine what that would do to a family, to a person? The tongue is also a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole body, sets the whole course of one's life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. So when you're going to go and gossip about somebody, remember the tongue that you're using is set on fire by hell, not by heaven. There's no justification. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and sea creatures have been tamed and are being tamed by mankind. But no human can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. That's what the brother of Jesus had to say about this whole subject. Now, the question for us is, how did Jesus handle people with a suspect past? How did he? Well, just think of a few of them. You've got the story of the woman of Samaria. That doesn't mean Samaria, it doesn't mean she was big. It means that she came from Samaria. Samaria was the nearest group to Israel, okay? You've got Israel all there and Samaria's there. And Samaria is hated by Israel and the Samaritans hate Israel, okay? Now, actually, their history is intertwined. But they're regarded by the Israelites as a mongrel people in that, sure, they were Jews, but they were married to all sorts of other groups, and the Jews believe Jews are Jews, and that's it. So they had nothing to do with each other. They detested each other. That's why Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan. Boy, holding up Samaria as being good would have been unpopular to his audience. Well, he's going down, and he's in Samaria. And it's very hot, and he stops by a well that had been supposedly found by Jacob years before. Jacob's well. Nobody else is around. It's a hot part of the day. No one comes out the hot part of the day. His disciples go into the town. They're going to get some food. Jesus is there. And a woman comes out. Why would a woman come out in the heat of the day? Because she's an outcast. She avoids people. Have you ever been through a stage where you avoided people? She avoided people because of her life. Comes up. She's there. She gets to the well. Jesus is there. And he said, could I have a drink of water? She was really taken back. She said, how come you, a Jew, ask me, a Samaritan, for water? Jesus said, the water that you'll get from there only lasts a moment. You'll drink it, it'll be gone. But he said, the water I could give you would last for everlasting life. What are you talking about? He said, go and get your husband. He said, I haven't got a husband. He said, no, you haven't. You've been married 5 times and the one you're living with now isn't your husband. He said, how do you know this? I've got to change the subject. So she gets on to religious doctrine. That's the best way to get off serious thought about God. She said, well, you say, you Jews, that you've got to worship God in Jerusalem, and we say Mount Moriah. And Jesus ignores that, just pushes it aside. Pushes it aside. The woman is so convinced by this strange, powerful man she's met, she goes back into the town, people she's avoiding. And she calls out to everybody, look, I have just met a man who's told me everything that I ever did. Come and hear him. Now see, here is a woman that probably everybody's avoiding, and Jesus seeks her out. He knew she was going to be there. When the disciples came back, they could not believe he was talking to a Samaritan. You know, what's going on? Christ accepts all of us, doesn't he? No matter who we are, who we are. Also Matthew had a bad reputation for a businessman. He worked for the Romans, who kept the Jews slaves. He was a tax collector. I mean, if you want to find the lowest of the low, it's tax collectors, because they take money from you. But in those days, they were taking money to give them to crooks. Okay? So he would have been regarded as a rich good for nothing that most people would have nothing to do with. They didn't like someone who took their money away, just like we have the same tendency to do. But our tax collectors don't give it to a foreign government, do they? They're part of us. They're just serving the country. In those days, you knew this man was a traitor. And Jesus comes up to him, I guess, about to be taxed. She had to pay as you came in and out the gate and all that kind of thing. And he says, follow me. Follow me. Can you imagine what those words must have meant? Obviously, Matthew knew about Jesus. Follow me. Peter and John had heard those words years before, hadn't they? Judas had heard those words. The rich young ruler heard those words, but he said no. He said, I can't give up my money. But Matthew does. And he follows Jesus and walks away from everything. Then he throws a party. Matthew's party is fantastic because here you've got a whole lot of people who are not in the usual mix of Jesus. It's like when you bring friends to church, people we want to reach for Christ, all of a sudden the church comes alive, doesn't it? We wouldn't be the same dead lot of Christians who sit here and sing our hymns and don't do anything about the kingdom. We would be Christians who were alive. And so Matthew brings all these people in. And I can see Jesus talking to people. I can see Peter there arguing with somebody over something. And Thomas using his scientific mind to explain. All this is going on. It's going wonderfully. And then the religious establishment arrived. The entrenched religious. And they break up this party and they say to Jesus, you know what this man is? He's worthless. He's a traitor. Had nothing to do with him. This doesn't say much for you, does it? And it goes on. And when it's all over, I can just see Matthew wringing his hands and saying, Jesus, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bring this on you. Because these Pharisees hated Jesus enough in the end to kill him. And Jesus is pleased with Matthew. See, worthless in the eyes of men, condemned by the religious establishment, but he's a follower of Jesus. He becomes a disciple of Jesus. Christ chooses people regardless of what they are. And you know the story of the woman caught in adultery. The blokes got away with it. They were okay, but the women got killed. They get stoned in those days. And that ugliness is still going on, isn't it, in some parts of the Middle East? You know the story. They all gather around, they've got their stones, but they want to set up Jesus so Jesus will say something against their law. What do you think? Do we kill her? Lord, Jesus, you're supposed to be God. He gets down and he writes something in the dirt. What did he write? Did he write the name of the girlfriends of the blokes with the stones? Some people suggested that was what it was. Whatever it was, it convicted them. And one by one they went away. And looking up, she looks in the face of Jesus. This woman who was inches from death. And he said, where are your condemners, woman? There are none, Lord. Neither do I condemn you, but go and sin no more. It's not that you're condoning the sin of anyone. It's just saying, look, God puts his arms around you and forgives you. You've got a fresh start. That's the message of salvation. I've told you this story before, but too bad because I like it. Just like I like a drink every now and then when my throat goes dry. One of my heroes of the faith was Dr. Robert Schuller of the Crystal Cathedral. Oh, people said all sorts of things against him. I remember I was speaking to the combined Anglican clergy of Sydney when Reverend Harry Goodhue was the Archbishop. He was a friend of mine and wanted me to talk to them about outreach of the church. And so I had this whole room full of Anglican preachers. And I quoted Robert Schuller. And a voice from the back came up, a very Anglican voice, and said, "Dr. McMurtry." I didn't have a doctorate in those days, but I thought so it sounded good. So he said, "Dr. McMurtry, surely you don't subscribe to the theology of Robert Schuller?" I said, "Heavens no, he baptises babies." Which, half the group laughed. Robert Schuller taught so many of us to think of the church for the outsider. Look, I'd go to his conventions often. The most famous ministers in the world of every denomination you can imagine would be there. And the message they would give when they would speak would be simply this. This is where it all began for me. Being there on those grounds, listening to Schuller, giving the vision, he was way ahead. And Dr. Robert Schuller was a minister with the Reformed Church, what we'd call the Dutch Reformed Church. He went through theological college and then went out to California in the Orange County, which today many of you have been to, but it wasn't like that then. It was orange groves and some buildings. He was sent there to start a new church. He borrowed money to get an organ. In those days, organs were very impressive in churches. And it was a little organ. It's on the back of a trailer. They're driving across the country. They get to Arizona. He sits down with his wife and they're having a meal in one of those Denny's or something. And he writes down ideas. Now, where could we meet? Because like us, they didn't have a building. So he wrote down 10 ideas. The 10th idea was hire a drive-in theatre. They looked at all sorts of, halls like this or Seventh-day Adventist churches because they've already finished with church by Sunday and things like that. And when he got there, he couldn't find any of those first 9 suggestions. Everything was taken because there was hardly anything. So what's he do? He goes to the owner of the drive-in theatre and he talks him into it at a church there. So here they are. Now they're on the roof of the kiosk and cars are coming in and people listening. And he got a great idea. He thought when he was a student, he got an opportunity to hear Norman Vincent Peale, the man who wrote Power of Positive Thinking. And he said, "Would you help me, Reverend Peale, one day to start a church?" And probably made some, "Oh yes, yeah, of course." So he writes to him and he says, "You promised, blah, blah, blah." And Norman Vincent Peale responded. Now, this man was hard to get. He's world famous. Come to a little church that meets on the roof, where he'd be standing on the roof of a kiosk to preach. So Norman Vincent Peale's there. So they're on the roof of the kiosk, places filled with cards because Norman Vincent Peale's going to be there. And he gets up and he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to introduce you today to the greatest individual that you could ever imagine. He has changed more lives than anybody I know. More people follow him than anyone else. He is just incredibly important. And here to tell you about him is Norman Vincent Peale." Well, Peale blushed and he got up. And this is what he said. These are great words. He's looking out over all these unchurched people who have come to this experimental church in motor cars. He gets up and he says, "What would Jesus say if he was here?" I don't think he'd tell you what rotten sinners you are because you already know that. He said, "As a matter of fact, Jesus never called anybody a sinner except the religious leaders." Schuller said, "Oh, sure, he was wrong." He said, "I'm quietly flipping through my red letter New Testament." But he was right. The one Jesus condemned were the religious, not the pagans. Not the pagans. If Christ our Lord can be that generous, how could we be otherwise?